Hey everyone, this is Dina Jones, one of the founders of Joe Bean Roasters. At Joe Bean, our mission, Coffee That Lifts Everyone, is about giving selling power back to coffee farmers, as well as purchasing power into the hands of our customers. Through our network of farmers, we're able to bring you naturally grown, amazing coffee directly. Our long-term farming partners negotiate pricing based on cost of production, as well as quality of product, not on fluctuating, unpredictable market prices. This enables them to create thriving businesses with bright futures. And our customers get empowered knowing exactly who grows their coffee and how, as well as knowing they are a part of a new, sustainable, global coffee network. To try our coffee, go to JoeBeanRoasters.com and be sure to check out our Perpetual Joy coffee subscription to receive a rotating selection of single-origin coffee delivered right to your door. Thank you to all our Rochester friends who have supported us and our farming partners so wonderfully over the years. You are making a difference with every bag.
Masters of couch potato style, punches and popcorn.
Welcome back to another episode of Punches and Popcorn, a martial arts podcast where we break down the best, the worst, the history, and the science of martial arts cinema. I'm your host, Michael Huntone, and with me today are my co-hosts, our genius and schlock apologist, Jason Bills.
That is me. Happy to be here.
And, of course, our own professor, the walking weapon, Dr. Dominic DeMore.
Oh, this was a fun one. I'm looking forward to it.
Tonight, we bring you another episode in our first official season, Once Upon a Time in the 80s, by taking on a true Hong Kong movie classic, 1985's Yes, Madam. To help us explore this amazing film, we have a very special guest. Kung Fu movie historian and expert, the man of a thousand commentaries, now also a movie producer, and so much more, the master of remaster, Frank Zhang!
Hey, how's it going, guys? Pleasure to be here.
Yes. Frank, I've said before, I feel like I've listened to you for hundreds of hours on all sorts of amazing film commentaries, this movie included. So excited to have you join us tonight and talk about this really incredible film from this great era of neon and mullets that we call the 80s.
Oh, yeah. And mad disco music. Yeah.
Yes. 1985's Yes, Madam, directed by the legendary Corey Ewan, directing just his second feature film, would introduce the martial arts world to two of its greatest stars, Academy Award-winning legend Michelle Yeoh in her first lead role, and International Sports Hall of Fame superstar Cynthia Rothrock. This buddy action comedy classic would kick off the girls with guns subgenre and lead to three sequels-ish in the Line of Duty series, which would also provide Donnie Yen with one of his early starring roles. But before we jump into this riot of a film, we need to start with a word from the razor-sharp genius of our own Jason Bills and his gospel, the Gospel of the Guillotine.
You got it, genius.
Genius.
I'm a genius.
He's geniusy.
Wile E. Coyote. Super genius.
Was it you, genius?
You little genius, you.
Being a genius certainly has its advantages.
All right, so this is something Frank touched on in his commentary. You were discussing overcranking and undercranking of film. It's something we really haven't discussed before, so I wanted to quickly touch on that. Basically, what that means is how fast the film is moving through the camera. Standard frame rate is 24 frames per second. That's kind of what we expect with movies, we love with movies. It's not reality. It's kind of like a dreamlike perception of reality. That's something that I still can't understand why Peter Jackson can't understand with his 48 frames with the Hobbit series. What I wanted to quickly discuss is the start of all this. So back in the day, obviously, I'm talking like early 1900s, motion picture cameras, film was fed through the actual, where the cranking term is, the cinematographer or the camera operator would literally be cranking the film through the camera. This led to experimentation. They started to undercrank or overcrank, just depending on how fast they were moving their arm. Let's first talk about overcranking. So it exposes more frames. It provides more detail to the eye. It's slowing down the movie image and basically what we know as slow motion. So I feel like not even like non-movie fans understand what slow motion is. Like some of the most memorable, iconic cinema moments have been in slow motion. Think about like a classic example being like the end of The Wild Bunch. Also just kind of more, I don't want to say recent, but it is sadly like recent for me as an old person, Reservoir Dogs, the gangsters walking in that slow motion, that's iconic. And then even more recently with the Matrix films, like the Wachowskis even came with a cool name with it, with Bullet Time. So that's what we know slow motion. But I think what kind of goes underanalyzed is undercranking a film. So moving less film through the camera to capture the image, speeding up the action. By moving less frames through it, it actually makes the image look more fast and gives it this more kinetic energy. So when I'm talking faster, it's not like a ton. It's instead of 24 frames per second, it's 22, maybe 20. So why I'm interested in this is this is on the Criterion disc of The Kid, the Charlie Chaplin film. There's a silent film expert. His name is Ben Modell, and he goes into great detail on this. This is sort of when it got on my radar. The extra is called A Study in Undercranking. And basically, he's saying that like Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, like our comedy silent film masters, they were kind of obsessed with this undercranking of film. And the reason is because they were kind of like the original like action cinema guys, and obviously comedy as well. It would add an extra zip. It would just make things a little more kinetic and interesting on film. And what's interesting about the Modell extra is he goes into say like in repertory screenings, like the projectionist will play it at 24 frames per second. And he says a lot of it falls flat. And he gives examples of this where then he has the projectionist run it at 22 frames, 20 frames per second. And the comedy all of a sudden, like it is more crisp. Like it is what they intended. And he even provides like notes from the cinematographers at the time where they intended it to be ran at this frame rate. So this isn't something new. Like this is something that they were doing at the dawn of cinema. And I think that's fascinating. Jumping ahead several decades, undercranking is still being used, overcranking too. People love slow motion. Let's talk to George Miller about that with Mad Max. But anyways, undercranking is still being used, and even in the movie we're talking about tonight with Yes, Madam. I was even listening to the commentary for the John Wick movies, and Chad Stahelski, he was talking about how they would undercrank a lot of the John Wick action scenes to kind of give them that extra pop and that extra zing. So I just think it's pretty interesting.
It's funny, side note, when I was a kid, I watched the original King Kong, the original one from the 30s, and it's about them going to the island filming the movie. And I thought it was crazy that they were cranking. You see them cranking the camera in that. And I remember going to my dad, I must have been like 7. And I'm like, what is he doing? And he's like, he's filming. And I'm like, well, isn't there like a battery? And he's like, oh no, they just cranked it with their hand. And I was like, that's wild. And so it's interesting you bring that up. I haven't thought about that in years. Excellent.
I always love catching under crank shots. Yeah. I always look at the background. If the people in the background somehow clap faster than they should be, like if the tree moves a bit faster, the wind blows faster, then I know, okay, that's an under crank shot. I mean, some of them are really obvious, especially like in Fist of Legend. I don't know. For whatever reason, they're on speed, man. I mean, like undercranking on Fist of Legend is like insane. And you can just tell it's almost like watching a Bugs Bunny cartoon sometimes, you know, or the Roadrunner cartoon. But normally they don't go that fast, you know, especially in your standard Sammo Hung Jackie Chan film. So that's when I kind of look at the background and see when they really undercrank some of the shot. Sometimes it'll be like a pleasant surprise when I see that, oh, actually they weren't undercranking here. But in the majority of some of these, like, you know, Sammo Hung or Jackie Chan films, you do see quite a lot of undercranking just based on the background. I mean, sometimes even in Schauberger films, you'll see slight undercranking. But I think they're master in doing that. You know, like the way they do it sometimes is so natural that you don't really notice it unless you look, you know, hard enough.
Yeah, and you don't want to notice it, I think, too, is like, yeah.
Right, yeah, I don't think I noticed or even thought about it until it was, I can't remember who it was, whether it was a director or probably a producer commentary on that Enter the Dragon disc I had, that he was, the gentleman that was giving it made sure to get across repeatedly, he's like, this is not sped up, like none of this, Bruce is this fast, like this is not, there's no enhancement to this, he actually moves this fast. Which is just enough. Then you watch and you're like, this guy was a superhuman.
Yeah, right.
And we have two people who I think have that unreal level of talent, whether it's the acting or the actual action, in this movie tonight, Yes, Madam. So this movie, as we kick into it, this is, so interestingly enough, I think when we are going to release this, when you're hearing this, this will be the first of a 1-2 Corey Yoon punch from us. To me, with some of the great films that we saw in the 80s came from Corey, and then, you know, some of the great action we saw later, including The Matrix that Jason had mentioned. Corey was involved in the action choreography and all that, the transporter, right? So this is a really interesting part for us to start. So I think I saw, if I was correct, this was Corey's second film as a director?
That is correct. That is his second film as a director. I think his first film was Ninja in the Dragon's Den, you know, with MCU in the seasonal films. So that was his first film, you know, with Hiroyuki Sanada, which of course now we know he's like everywhere now, you know, Conan Lee, you know, and Hong Jung-ri. And I mean, yeah, so that was his first film. That was his directorial debut for seasonal film. And then, of course, that film was also, you know, the martial arts was also done by him and Meng Hoi. And then this was the follow-up, you know, this was like a follow-up to that film. And, of course, they did this for, you know, D&B films, which at that time were just like starting up, you know, Dixon Poon, the businessman, jewelry, watchman guy. You know, I mean, he's in the luxury watch and jewelry business, but he's also a movie lover. He wants to start a studio, so he recruited Sammo and John Shum. And John Shum, of course, who played Curly in the Lucky Star film, you know.
Yes.
To start this little, you know, studio called D&B. D, of course, Dixon, you know, from Dixon. Bo from Hong Kong Bo, Sammo's Chinese, you know, name.
Oh, yes.
Right, it's D&B, you know. So, yeah, and they wanted a hit. You know, they wanted to kind of like, you know, let people know, hey, we mean business, we're serious, you know, we want to, you know, come out with a bang. And so that's why they, you know, made Yes, Madam. And of course, it was a very successful film.
And he, Corey knew Sammo from, so I know they both were part of the Seven Little Fortunes from the Peking Opera mm-hmm. School. Were they in that together at the same time, or they were kind of different generations?
No, they were the same period. They were saying, I mean, okay. Sammo being the big brother, you know, Sammo the oldest.
Right, right.
The younger, but no, they're all from the same Peking Opera School. Meng Hoi is not. Meng Hoi is from a different school. Meng Hoi is from Sangha School. So it's a different school, you know. But yeah.
And we've talked about the Seven Little Fortunes a little bit when we did Drunken Master, because of course Jackie was there and Yen Biao. And it was cool to see again that Sammo, so that connection there, I'm assuming like that's part of where, I know Corey was acting before this, but how we got into kind of this role and directing this film. And just the one other person I wanted to mention that you brought up. So Sammo's partner in this studio, Dixon Poon, remember that, yeah. Right? So I know he was married to Michelle. Were they married yet when this came out?
No. It's from recruiting Michelle to star in this film that he met Michelle. So that led to a marriage and then a divorce, obviously. Yeah.
Right.
No. Hey, Frank, was like Hong Kong, it just feel like these guys are so versatile, like in a, you know, United States or, you know, North American film, it's like, you know, we have our actors, we have our directors, we have our stunt crew, like these guys did it all. Is that pretty common that they're, you know, like Sammo, like Corey, like they're not acting, they are acting, they're directing, they're in the stunt team. Like,
yeah.
It just blows my mind how gifted.
Yeah, because
they
learned their craft from a very young age. You know, like when they were in the opera school, they were already recruited to be both stunt performers as well as actors, mm-hmm. like Meng Hoi, for instance. When they need kid actors, they say, hey, you know, go to the school and find a few of them. You know, we need some kids. And right. That's how they ended up in the film. I mean, like, you look at Come Drink With Me, and like Mars of them, you know, in that film, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I think a couple other people in, you know, in those films as well. So like even, you know, when they were a kid, they were already acting in films. And as they grew a little bit older, they started doing stunts. They were performing at, like, you know, they're performing at amusement parks. They're doing Peking opera shows. And amusement park. So this is almost like their daily routine. Like one day they would do the show, the other day they go act in the movie, and then the other day they would do stunts. So like, you know, they're just like, they live and breathe this studio thing. That's why they were able to learn the craft so easily. because they just kind of take everything in, you know.
Mm-hmm. So great.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, let's jump into the movie, guys. All right, so let's start. Our story begins in Yes, Madam, with a bang, as we and the world are quickly introduced to Michelle Yeoh, who wastes no time displaying epic levels of badassery. So one of the things I noticed, Frank, was in our like Slack chat, I asked the guys, I noticed that there's two different openings for this movie based on, again, I'm working off of the 88 Films disc that has the original Hong Kong release, and then it has the English, was like an English export version, right? That has a police raid that goes wrong, and then they like go into a marathon. And I remember like the scene, I was like, wait, am I watching the right movie? But the one that I think we found both is the Hong Kong version and what is on streaming on Tubi right now really, to me, sets the tone for this movie. And we get this flasher sting operation.
Yeah, the English version opens with a sequence on where it's off as a tuba. You know, that's a different film. That's Samuel.
Oh, is that
right?
Right.
Yeah. So that's from a different film, and then you have David Chang, Shelburne, as an actor,
right.
Who actually turns up later playing a completely different character in that little cameo thing.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So that whole, you know, for the English export version is a completely different scene from a different movie. The flasher in the bookstore thing has always been the official opening sequence of this film.
I mean, Dom, Jay, what did you think when you started the movie and this is how it began?
Well, I think it set the tone. It's a goofy movie. Like, let's just call a spade a spade. It's a pretty goofy movie. Like, and what I actually really liked about it is I found it to be, the tone to be pretty consistent, even though there are bits in it that are super duper duper dark. It doesn't tonally shift for me. I found it what it started with is, you know, you had this flasher who seems cartoony guy peeking around books, and you have Michelle being all like flirty and cute, and I'm like, well, I already know she's the star, and I already know she's a cop, and I already know she's a kick-ass, so clearly something's going on. And then boom, when they slam him in the book, I was like, yes, yeah, okay, I'm in for this. This is good. And it's sillier than I expected, but it's silly in a good way. In a way it's a dark comedy. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. It's got everything going on. There's drama, there's comedy. I love the tonal shifts in it. It just feels kind of unique. Cause I think like what I'm used to with like American movies, like, oh, I'm going to a drama, I'm going to a comedy. Like this is everything at once. And I really enjoy it.
Well, tonal shift are a common element in Hong Kong films. And it kind of derived from how some of these, like, you know, some of the films were released during like holiday season or Chinese New Year season, where they have to kind of make sure that all demographics would get enjoy out of it. So like, you know, there's a little bit of everything for like people who like drama, people like comedy, and so which is why you see a lot of tonal shift. I mean, this film in particular, like, you know, I mean, it kind of gets a little bit melodramatic near the end when one of the characters dies. So
yeah, right, one of my favorite characters.
But I mean, I think for the most part the film is still kind of like a comedy until that part, and then of course the ending is really kind of dark. So
but a great opening, like ladies are taking over, like let's get these pervy guys out of the way, let's let the ladies take charge.
And I love too how quickly it transitions from that to this armored car robbery, and the violence just like goes up to 11 immediately. Like I was not expecting, and I could see where like this inspired this, the girls with guns, that like Michelle just starts like literally blowing people away, like sending them flying off of rooftops or the, you know, the cars. So and I was not expecting that level of.
Yeah. What's great about that is because they were doing a homage to Long Arm the Law, the 1984 drama, which kind of, you know, garnered a lot of awards, I think, including Best Picture and the Hong Kong Film Awards. And the three robbers from this opening sequence were the same three robbers in Long Arm the Law. So it's kind of like a little semi-reunion plus a little homage to that film. So for those who've seen that film, they will recognize these three guys. Oh, yeah, those are the guys from Long Arm the Law. So it's almost like, oh, they came back from the dead, and now they're robbing an armored car. So, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of in-joke, you know, cinematic in-joke for audiences who've seen that film.
Oh, that's really cool. And so this was, so talking about introducing Michelle Yeoh, this was her first feature film. So, Frank, can you give me a little background? Like, where did Michelle come from before this? Because I don't think, in my mind, like, I can't ever think of a time where she wasn't a like international superstar. So it's wild to me to think like, oh, people didn't really know her yet.
Well, she's from Malaysia. She grew up in Ipoh, which is a nice little city famous for the food. And she studied dance at the Royal Academy of Dance. She went to the UK and studied dance. But I think but because of an injury, she kind of had to back out of it. And so she was thinking, well, what should I do? And then I think unbeknownst to her, her mom actually enrolled her, applied for a beauty pageant for her, and she won the beauty pageant. And then in Hong Kong, Dixon Poon was, he was trying to do a commercial for his jewelry and watch business.
Oh, right.
And the commercial, I think, involved Jackie Chan as well. And they're looking for a female partner to go with Jackie Chan in the commercial. So they're looking at pictures and stuff. And then lo and behold, right, Dixon saw a picture of Michelle Yeoh. And then he said, well, let's try her. I want her. And so,
right.
And then they flew Michelle to Hong Kong, and they found that she was a good fit, did the commercial. Dixon liked it and signed her to a contract to star in his films. And so that's how it all got started.
So, yeah, then now she shows up in this movie. And again, I think right away, in terms of establishing a character, we get all that right away. The comedy, the action. I was sold on her right away.
Not to mention Dirty Harry homage.
Oh yeah. Right, with the shot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So good. Yeah, I can't believe she stopped her dancing or ballet career because of injury, because like a lot of times I'll watch these movies and at the end they'll have the, the outtakes, and she's been injured quite a bit in film. So it's like, oh, that's so funny that she gave up one career. Like, but she stuck with this career. I think it was the right choice.
Yes. Yeah, agreed. All right. So then carrying on to the movie, we then are introduced to the character of Richard Noman, who kind of proves the crux for kicking off all the major plot threads in this film. So we get this scene in the hotel room where, so it establishes for us kind of the threads that are going to carry us through the movie. One, Michelle Inspector Ng. Am I pronouncing that right, Frank?
Actually, it's
Okay, thank you. So
not easy, I know. Richard, just like Richard or Francis
Okay, excellent. So yeah, so we're introduced to, we were introduced to her, and now we learn about her connection to this guy who's visiting from Britain that she had trained with when she was with Scotland Yard. We find the assassin who comes to meet him. We learn about this shady underworld figure, Mr. Tin. And we also are introduced to the other buddies of this movie. Are two, at this point, we just know them as two thieves. So there's a lot going on in this scene. And I think that for me, it was, until I rewatched it, it was hard to properly appreciate everything that's going on in this moment. You know, one of the things that I love that you called out, Frank, in your commentary, that really is a credit to Corey's direction, is the, especially with the two thieves, he does a lot of cuts where you keep thinking it's one of them, but then it's the other one.
Right.
And I remember those same things, like where you see the one getting out the service staff uniform, and then the next thing you see a white sleeved arm with the, and you think, oh, he's going and doing this, but then, oh no, this is a totally different guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you right away kind of see them working together.
No, it's deliberately throw you off so that it really established the, you know, it's the character, because their fees, their petty fees, and like, you know, kind of like throwing you off. And that's what they do. Their goal is to throw you off so that they can con you. So, and I just like how that was, like that theme is, you know, realized visually by Bill Wong, the cinematographer. You know, like you see man's feet, you think it's his feet, it's actually John Chung's feet. And you see the hand, you think it's one of their hands, but it's Dick White's hand, you know, the assassin's hand.
Right. So,
yeah, no, I just like little visual stuff like that. You know, I'm trying to point out visual flourishes like that with my commentary so people can notice, like, you know, this is actually rather skillful, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we talk about Dick Way? That guy has presence. The assassin?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
That guy has presence. Yeah. I remember the first, that scene with him, I remember saying, I want to watch every movie with this guy because he is a scary, yeah. Imposing, like immensely imposing character. And I thought he did a superb job. Arguably my favorite character in the movie. Like, yeah. I thought he was spectacular.
Yeah, one of the classic Hong Kong villains. I mean, you know, I mean, remember he used to be Taiwanese. I mean, he's a real Taiwanese army guy. You know, that's his background. You know, he studied martial arts back in junior high, and then, you know, he did competition, and then he, like, you know, because, you know, in Taiwan is a mandatory enrollment once you reach 18. You know, even if you're like a pop star, like, you, like, let's say, you know, if you're like the top 20 pop star, you still got to go to army for 2 years. You know,
right. So,
and he was an instructor in combat, you know, taekwondo and karate and all that stuff. So yeah, you know, he's in the army, man. So yeah, no, I think he's one of the great Hong Kong screen villains of all time.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then in your interview with Cynthia Rothrock, even though it's kind of jumping ahead in the movie, like she recalls, like, oh, when I had to fight him, like, everyone was warning me, like, he doesn't.
Oh yeah. No, he doesn't. He does full body contact. Yeah. He doesn't do, he doesn't do cinematic fighting, you know.
Right.
Yeah, that was, and I'm sure we'll talk about it as we get into some of the fights in this movie. Like, man, every time he starts moving, like, that dude looks lethal. Mm-hmm. Now, one question I wanted to ask you. So we're introduced to the thieves, and this was, so when I watched the different versions and then how things are credited in an IMDb, Frank, I'm hoping you'll help me understand kind of the difference. So the Hong Kong version that I watch, the two thieves are Ceridan and Strepsis?
Yeah, those are British. Those are British name. I mean, like, British medicine name. So Mang Hoi is aspirin.
Okay.
And then John Shum was Strepsil, which actually I have some at my home right now.
Oh, right.
Those are lozenges, you know, sore throat lozenges from Britain. They really work too. So yeah, I mean, it's common for Hong Kong comedy to have interesting nicknames for the comedic characters. So, you know, like, especially like, you know, the Lucky Star series, all of them are named after herbs, right? You know, I mean,
okay,
named after herbs. And so here they were named after, you know, like medicine. So, you know, Strepsils for John Shum. Panadol is actually like the British version of Tylenol, except it's much more effective. So Panadol for Trey Hark, and then aspirin for Mang Hoi. So yeah,
yes,
those are the names they use in the Hong Kong version. Yes.
So right, and that's what we saw in like the English dub version that I think is streaming now, that it used those. And I want to say, at least the subtitles in the 88 films version, it said like Panadol. It had, his name is Tokudan.
Oh yeah, Tokudan. I'm sorry, yeah, not aspirin. Sorry, Tokudan. Tokudan's a Japanese medicinal patch.
Okay.
For like, you know, arthritis. It's a very popular, you know, medicine. It's like Salonpas. So it's Japan version of Salonpas.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, I wondered.
Isn't it like Bengay? Because I know it's got menthol in it.
Yeah, menthol, but it's not liquid. It's patches.
Yeah.
You put it on your shoulder and stuff. Yeah.
Spoiler alert. This is my science segment, by the way. So that's no problem, but like, oh, so I knew it right away. I'm like, wait, why are these three goofballs named after over-the-counter medications from Europe? So it's always going to be brought up. So Panadol, I remember, because when I worked with Australians, they're like, oh, if you have a headache, you should take Panadol. And I'm like, what? And then it was like, oh, it's Tylenol. And then,
yeah, it's more effective than Tylenol, because Panadol has paracetamol. That's a very effective ingredient for pain, whereas Tylenol doesn't have it. So that's
okay.
Anyway,
all right. Well, I'll get to it. We're jumping in.
By this point, all the plot threads are kind of moving forward. We're starting to see what's the actual story here. So we find, with Noman's passport in hand, we're introduced to, and we're kind of before this, but we actually get to know, again, as I said, the other buddies in this film, that you could argue they're actually the primary buddies of this film, and that's Strepsil and Aspirin, and their forger friend, Panadol, whose passport business is about to give them into a lot more trouble than they could imagine.
Yeah, and I'm always surprised that in the credits, Troy Hart was billed as a special guest star when he actually played a much bigger role in the film. I mean, like, you know, because if you read the opening credit, he's actually billed as a special guest star. But he's actually one of the main actors. I mean, along with, you know, John and Meng Hoi. So.
And that's kind of what knocked me out, because it's Troy Hart there. Like, he's one of my favorite, like, directors, like, in Once Upon a Time films. Like, even, like, recently, more recently, like, Detective D films. Like, I don't know if he was just an actor.
Oh, but anyways, Detective D
are great. They're so good. And it's like, if one of us, like, if you're watching like an American film and like Ridley Scott shows up for this really interesting character role in the '80s, like it just blows my mind that, oh, he's also a director. He's also on, you know, I mean, it's just, these guys are so gifted.
No, it's them getting back. I mean, it's Corey and Meng Hoi getting back to Troy Hart for the hard work they did on Zoo Warriors, because they worked so hard on Zoo Warriors that they say, you know, we got to get back to Troy Hart one day. And then, of course, when Samuel said, well, who do you want to play this character? Oh, we're going to get Troy Hart.
And they put him through it.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah, I love that. The first scene where we meet him is just, is great. That, you know, we're introduced to him and he gets the, again, we see what he does with the passport. We're introduced to that he also, he counterfeits the guns too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Which will be very important later in the movie. And again, we get the, so we get a really fun kind of a fight scene in his apartment in this kitchen there. And then I love that his friend, when Aspirin and Strepsil come back, they do this like fake being police to get the other guys to run away. So, you know, it establishes their friendship and all that together. And we get to see their little, I just love the image of their like shared little money box. That,
oh yeah. Oh, I love that. Yeah.
That they all have their own key. Like,
it's like the Three Stooges, these guys. They were just so goofy and so funny.
Right. And but again, it establishes like their relationship. And then we get, kind of not long after this, we get to meet their master, who's just this wild scene that to me feels like the most fever's dream scene of the entire movie, at the nursing home with their master, who is, of course, one of the producers of this film. And the legendary Sammo Hung. But also, I didn't realize until afterwards that one of the other roommates is David Chiang, who's in a million Shaw Brothers movies, and Richard Ng. So, again, in that room, and we get played this whole plot where you think they're going to, like, assault the nurse.
Yeah, it's like they're going for the food where you think they're going for the boobs. Yeah.
Yes. When they go for the food, it's relief. Yeah. They just want some good food.
Who cares about a boob?
Yeah. Right. And then I love they show up to, like, pay him honor with, like, this cookie tin that's actually full of, like, chicken.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the food at this place is really bad.
Yeah, I mean, the comedy, you know, is typical of the screenwriter, the late Barry Wong, you know, who would later work with Stephen Chow on, you know, the Fight Back to School stuff. So that's kind of like his humor, you know, a lot of Cantonese wordplay. But yeah, that is just his typical way of, you know, the humor that you saw in that one scene.
And it's interesting that, again, like, so this is a movie, you know, we've talked about, like, it was Michelle Yeoh's first starring role. You know, when you look at, like, the posters for it, she's front and center, you know, with Cynthia Rothrock. You know, there's, like, and I'm sure we'll probably talk about that, there was, like, even the first poster that came out, there was... I saw Cynthia talking about how, like, she was kind of like
sidetracked, but then they told her it's deliberate to get, like, kind of keep her surprised. But
right. And she, because again, at this point, like, we've only seen Michelle just a little bit in, you know, the first scene and some of the scenes at the police station and at the hotel afterwards. But really, all this action is going through these guys,
right?
But they bring it back because. So if I understood it right, Sammo gave them the suggestion, is their master gave them the suggestion that, you know, this guy, they discovered that the passport they stole belonged to this, the British guy that, So they're starting to realize this is probably more important than we just thought. We were going into different hotel rooms to rob them, right? Mm-hmm. So now they need to do something, and they come up with this plan, right, that they're going to tell the police,
yep,
this guy has it, so go bust him, and yep, that'll get off our tail, and that brings yep Michelle back into it.
And I love how Trey Hart would make that phone call, and then, you know, he's like doing this voice, you know, voice acting. Yeah. I thought that was great, you know, but yeah.
Yeah.
Again, they decide this best course of action is to tip off the cops, and this takes us to the dramatic action scene at the Hong Kong airport.
Right, the old Kai Tak airport, yeah. It was an old airport, you know, I mean, they built it in 1925. It was supposed to close right on the day of the handover on July 1st, 1997, so that the new airport could take over, you know, over there on Lantau Island. But because of the delay, they actually ended up having the old, you know, it's called Kai Tak Airport. They ended up having the airport operating for another year. Yeah.
And they filmed this, you said they filmed this in the airport, right? But they had to do it like one night. Yeah, one night. All of this in one night.
Yeah, one night to shoot it, yes.
Was it common for them to use actual locations versus just like recreating at a studio?
If they get permission, sure. Like airport is, you know, yeah. I mean, it's much easier. I mean, as long as they get permission to shoot, it's much easier, you know. But here, no, they got permission to shoot at the airport because back then, it's not a 24-hour airport. So like planes cannot take off because it's right next to a residential area. So airplanes cannot have airplanes flying between, I believe, 11 and 7 or 6. Yeah, so not to wake up the people. So they have that hour. They have the window.
Now, and do you think some of that, too, is like just that decision to either shoot things live or in studio? Do you think any of that has to do, too, with, I'm assuming, like DMB is comparatively small to something like Shaw that's got, Shaw had their massive studio set.
If you watch the majority of DMB film was shot on location, they don't have a studio. They don't have a lot, unlike Shaw or Harvard's. They have to rely on location shooting, which is why almost all DMB films hardly have any sets, unless, with the exception of maybe like, I don't know, Dream Lover.
Right,
where you have to build a set because it's set in Song Dynasty, you know. So, but
So this epic airport battle gives us the opportunity to finally meet our other lead, Cynthia Rothrock, who gave us, in my opinion, one of the most amazing fight introductions in all of 80s cinema.
Oh yeah, definitely that scorpion kick that she's known for. Yeah, oh yeah,
yeah, so good.
Kicks him in the face and.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I have to remember the ironic thing is, you know, when Corey went to the U.S. to look for a Western to come and do this film, he meant to look for a guy, but he couldn't find any suitable male fighter or martial artist. But Cynthia caught his eye, and so, you know, I mean, because Yes Man originally was supposed to be either about two guys or one guy and one girl. It's not supposed to be two girls,
but right.
This is, you know, let's make this about two girls. So
Cynthia is way overqualified too. I always knew she was a professional martial artist, but she is like professional martial artist in like five martial arts. Like she does like eagle claw, kung fu, karate, taekwondo,
and five shadows kung fu.
She's just insane. Like
forms and weapons. Yeah.
Her favorite weapon is the hook sword, I found out, which is pretty badass. Like, yeah. So I was very I was like, wow, she is way, way overqualified for this. And it shows. I loved all the scenes with her. Like, you could just tell that she knows exactly what she's doing. Really awesome. Awesome mullet, too. Like, they have dual mullets. That's actually what the takeaway from this movie. We got two lady cops with dual 80s mullets. I was like, this is perfect.
They're such 80s haircuts, right? Like,
and 80s
clothes. Oh yeah, this was full of 80s stereotypes, like the microfilm. Yeah. It's like, oh, it's like the secrets of the universe are on the microfilm. That's before it was the disc. Like that was the 90s. Right. Like it turned from it. Right. Go back in time, the microfilm. Yeah,
the monitors.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I love again just some of the kicks that she delivers in that scene. Unreal.
Well, you mentioned the scorpion kick. She does that double kick a lot, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. Where she flies forward and kicks with both feet. Oh, it's great. And that's got to hurt when you land. Like,
on heels, too. My ass. he's
right, right.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, you know, I watched the Hong Kong version, and you know, one of the things that that they play is like a surprise in it is that she speaks Cantonese, and they're like, oh wow, she speaks this. And I remember watching this being like, oh wow, that's surprising. Like knowing this is an early film for her, I'm like, so she knew this coming in. But I think, did I read, so she didn't speak Cantonese, and because this is like many of the films, and this we've talked about this in some of our other films too, it's all the sound is done is added in post.
Voice actors, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they said that like right, that they just gave her like words that are like kind of similar to get the mouth movements, and then so she had like no idea what she was saying, and
no script. She was just told what to say. Like they're just gonna get, they just gave her a very rough idea of what she's saying, and then just have her speak either gibberish or numbers or count numbers, or just like you said, try to, you know, come up with mouth movements that are similar to the actual dialogue.
Yeah, that had to be. And how old was Cynthia when she made, like, she was pretty young.
She was in her early 20s, I believe.
Had to be a bit, like, to come all the way to Hong Kong to be in this movie, only be able to speak with two, like, man, what an introduction, right?
Yeah, she thought she was going to be in a costume drama wearing Chinese, you know, traditional Chinese garb.
Right, right.
And then she got to Hong Kong and said, oh, no, you're a cop from Scotland. He said, what?
Right. Frank, is that a transition at this time, like more contemporary settings? Because like I'm used to seeing like, you know, almost like period dramas. Like is that like something that was more prevalent?
Oh yeah, with the Lucky Star film. Yeah, with the Winner of the Sinners. Yeah. I mean that is the real transition when Sammo and Jackie started doing the Lucky Star film with Winner and Sinners in 83, I believe. So that was that kind of really start the modern action film era. Now keep in mind that Winners and Sinners are really more like comedy with action. And then once they started doing the other, like My Lucky Stars and stuff, that's when action kind of takes a more, center role. But yeah, no, this was the start of the modern costume contemporary action film.
It's really refreshing. I don't know what about, there's just this energy or this, I don't know. I just really like.
Yeah, and of course, and that's why Police Story is such a groundbreaking film, because Police Story was really Jackie Chan's answer. Like Jackie Chan, like I'm done with period films, you know.
Right.
Like after, especially after Dragon Lord didn't win the box office, you know, it lost to Aces Go Places too, I think. So anyway, I mean, Dragon Lord was number two, and they all thought that it's gonna be number one. So when that happened, Jackie felt, no, forget it, no more costumes, no more period martial arts film.
So Cynthia's arrived. They've got their first lead to Richard's murder in handcuffs. And we get to see two very different investigation styles with our two detectives as they try to walk their own paths towards justice.
Yeah, Cynthia's definitely the bad cop here. Like, they definitely have the good cop, bad cop dynamic.
Yeah, it's interesting. I like that it really gave depth to, especially Michelle's character, because we saw in the beginning, as we mentioned before, you know, she's got that scene where, like, get a gun in her hands and she's a badass, right? But then she also, like, she's not just the cop who's down there kicking down doors and all action. Like, she's comfortable and she likes working in this level of subtlety. Like, the repeated times, this isn't the first or the last time where she'll let a guy go specifically so that she can follow them, right? Where Cynthia's lock literally put me in a dark room with this guy so I can beat the hell out of him.
Yeah.
And it's fun, like you said, is a staple of buddy cop comedies, right? Like, it makes me think of like a Lethal Weapon or something. Yeah. Like, these guys have to start out hating each other, because then when they eventually come together, then it's, all right, we're on. So, so we will walk towards there. But I think before we move forward, this is probably a good place for us to take a break. We'll continue our discussion into Yes, Madam.
Hi there, this is Magnus of The Mind of Magnus, a show dedicated to help expanding the mind that I have in this big skull of mine. I've grown up with the love of factoids and curious about the world, so I'm taking the time to interview all the most amazing people I've met. So join me for The Mind of Magnus. You can find it at magnusapollo.com. And if you have a guest, you want to be a guest, you want to learn more about what's going on in this world, please join me here on the Lunchador Podcast Network.
Welcome back to another episode of Punches and Popcorn, and we are tonight talking about Yes, Madam, 1985's Hong Kong classic, and we have with us very special guest, Hong Kong kung fu movie film superstar, expert extraordinary, the great Frank Zhang.
All of them is not true. No, just kidding.
Frank, we have a thing that we like saying on Punches and Popcorn, and that if we state it in the podcast, it immediately becomes podcast fact. So you could try to deny your title of all-around master and superstar, but in the Punches and Popcorn world, this is now a stated fact.
All right.
Keep in mind, we have anointed Bolo Young and to as a saint. So
he is our patron saint.
Yeah. So
we do love Bolo.
So we honor many here.
Okay.
We do.
Thank Bolo. Okay.
All right. Coming back to Yes, Madam, where we left off, our hero cop duo of Cynthia Rothrock and Michelle Yeoh had teamed up and started investigating the murder of Richard Noman, which really turned into this search for the missing microfilm that would hold evidence that would bring down the underworld king Tin's empire. So after being saved by Inspector Moss, a really interesting scene, after, again, we mentioned Michelle has a different way of investigating that involved, in this moment, releasing the passport guy. Did we ever even get his name?
He doesn't have a name. I looked on the, he was just Thug.
Thug.
Thug with so passport. Thug.
Yeah, passport guy. He leads them to our favorite forger, the wonderful Panadol. And Carrie has to, which is, again, another great fight scene that leads to just this really ridiculous action scene or moment where Cynthia Rothrock's character rescues him by shooting the rope that's strangling him.
I thought it was going to be like Disney's Tarzan. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that. You know, I was the villain there. Like, yeah, he gets hung by vines. I was like, oh, they're going to kill this guy this way? Disney stole it from that? But no.
I thought, see, me as the old Spider-Man guy, thought maybe he would get Gwen Stacy'd, and I was glad that he didn't. But he gets rescued and brought into the station where he tries to protect his friends because even though we see there's some conflict going on between Aspirin and Panadol and they don't really like each other, it's clear that Strepsil and him are fond of each other and Panadol's a good friend. He doesn't want to incriminate his friends, but he ends up doing it anyways.
You know what? I was thinking throughout this movie as I was watching it, how if you took the comedy out, this could be a pretty dark thriller. Mm-hmm. Like I was thinking the plot, like take out the comedy, take out the fact that there's the goofballness about a lot of things. I mean, you have forged documents, assassins, thieves, you know, violent cops. And this movie could, I don't think it should be remade, but it could be remade like in a very like kind of dark way. And I think it would be pretty good. So I think there was an interesting thing about this movie. It had all the plot points to make for a very dark cop thriller, but it wasn't really dark at all because the characters were so fun and done so well.
Yeah, it's interesting that we get this moment where Panadol ends up accidentally fingering his friends to the cops. Meanwhile, while this is going on, we find that these two guys are back in the game. They're out. We get this hilarious scene where they attempt to hustle at a pool hall. They quickly find out they are the ones getting hustled and almost get in big trouble. But we get our assassin, Dick Way, comes back in to rescue them, sort of.
Yeah, I love this scene. I mean, you get to see Dick Way do his thing, which is great. It beats up all those guys.
Yeah.
And then they're like, who is this guy? Is he our friend? And then he chases after them on like a dirt bike. Is that the correct scene? That was awesome. I was like, yeah, very cool.
And so 80s too, because if there's one thing that's super 80s to me, it's a dirt bike.
I love how convenient it is. You have actual three cars actually just lined up so he can do that little stunt there.
Right.
By the way, the car stunt was done by the late Blackie Ho, who Yeah, you probably have seen him in many films. He was in like Wheels on Meals. It was in New Tiger Fighter Dragon. So
right. So now they finally these guys start to understand they're in the middle of something a little bigger than they expected. And they have to be rescued multiple times, right? Like there's this moment where they're kind of rescued by Dick Way for a moment until they realize he's chasing him too. And then I think it's not long after this also where they have that moment with the traffic cops. It's just some of the scenes like that, or like the pool hall scene. Again, I think I talked about the master scene is like fever dream. That it's just remembering back. I'm like, oh, there's also all these like random goofy fight moments.
Correct me if I'm wrong. There's normal cop and like a state cop or something, and they both want to give a ticket to a car, yep. And they're competing over that. That's some comic relief. And then the two thieves are like, we want to get arrested. How can we get arrested? Let's assault a police officer. That's a great way to get arrested. And that's where that scene goes. Right. And they just have to pick which one to beat up. And there's this back and forth. I thought was pretty funny. And then they beat the guy up and they brings him in. But he doesn't want to admit he got beaten up. So they're like, assaulting an officer, right? And he's like, no. And they're like, no. That's definitely an offense.
Oh, and this is after... Because there are so many of these scenes happening so fast. Isn't this after... So when they first get attacked by the assassin, isn't that where they stumble into the bar where Inspector Ng and Carrie are investigating, trying to track down the...
Right, they're looking for them. Yeah, they were looking for,
right. Because they come in and they're like, oh, there's those guys right there.
Yeah. And then they have that great bar fight. I mean, bathroom fight. That's a wonderful bathroom.
Yes.
That's where Michelle and Cynthia kind of recognize what's actually going on, even though these guys don't.
Right.
I read somewhere that bartender is the guy that plays the crew that that trains Jean-Claude Van Damme in.
Well, the bartender is the brother of Philip Chan, really? Dennis Chan. He's like the Stanley Tucci of Hong Kong. He's like he's a veteran actor who always often play like these jerks, you know. Because he has the look of a jerk. he's you know, his brother Philip Chan, of course, the famous actor and screenwriter who used to be a cop. And he's a cop turned screenwriter and actor. You know, he was like Chow Yun Fat's superior in Hard Boiled. You know, he was superior in like the Super Cop, I think. Yeah, so yeah, he's been in many films.
And just in here, just as a bartender, it's like if you didn't know. You would completely forget about him because it's sandwiched between several fights, right?
Yeah, it's very common to have, like, sometimes you have, like, big star actor doing just very quick cameos or known actors doing cameos.
Right, mm-hmm. And I think we talked about before, that's one of the things I love about listening to your commentaries when you just connect those threads there. There's so many of those things I wouldn't even recognize because, you know, it's so fast. Yeah, so that's cool. And then that takes us to the cop fight. To try to get arrested, and they discover, they can't keep themselves in jail as much as they want to. And once they're when our family of rogues is finally reunited and understands the danger they're in, they discover the microfilm and the danger and value of the microfilm that they hadn't realized they possessed. And they just come to this moment where they decide there's basically two paths they can take. They can take the easy way and give this thing up, or the hard way and go after the money. Again, we kind of have within these three this dynamic where Aspirin and Panadol do not like each other. They kind of hate each other and are bickering all the time. You know, it's clear Strepsil and Panadol, like they're very close to each other. But in this moment, the alliances shift because Strepsil is the one that's like, we want to get out of this, right? Like, just give this to the cops. And the other two decide the money behind this could be a little better.
Yeah. Don't they give the cops the fake? Is that what ends up happening? And then the cops arrest the big boss. And like, then he calls him up and he's like, no, it's a fake. Don't worry about it. And I was like, oh, that sucks. Could you imagine being a cop in that circumstance? Be like, oh, I have evidence against you. And then they're like, nope. And then the guy knows it and just makes an ass out of you guys. It was, ugh. And what was the villain's name? Can you remind me? Is it Tin or Tin?
Tin.
Tin. Tin. I really wish I could have heard what the original. Yeah. Yeah. What the original actor's cackle sounded like, because I only watched the dub, and he had this great like, and I'm just like, this guy's awesome. What did I would really like to know what the original actor sounded.
And we know this actor,
James Tin, right? You talk about James Tin. Yeah. Yep. I mean, Bruce Lee's second fiddle. Yeah.
Yep. He was in Fist of Fury that we started 2023 with.
Yeah, he was supposed to be the star of the big boss, and then he was overshadowed by Bruce Lee. And then from then on, he was always overshadowed. And he's, when we come to Jackie Chan, he's also overshadowed by him. And by this time, he's playing like villains and side characters.
Frank, since these are all like audios added after the fact, would the actors playing the roles?
Very, very rarely do they dub their own voices because of how busy they are. But some actors insist on dubbing their voices because their voices are so well known. So like Chow Yun-fat always dub his own voice. Tony Leung always dub his own voice. Yeah, Anthony Wong always dub his own voice. But no, in this case, yeah, I think
that's interesting.
No, I mean, here almost none of them dub their own voices in this film.
Do you have a preference? I mean, I guess subtitled would be great, but versus dub, like, since we're not really hearing the original audio either way, like, do you frown upon a dub? I just know because, like, when I was a child watching these movies, it was always dubbed, so I have like a special place.
I completely understand, but I didn't grow up watching these dubs, so I really don't have any emotional attachment to a dub track. And so when uh-huh. like, you know, when there's an announcement of a title and then people message me and ask, do you know which dub version is on? Like, there's like different dub, like British dub, UK dub, export dub. It's like, I mean, I don't know, man. Yeah. I only know the Cantonese version, so yeah.
So I will say for me with the dubs, it is 90% of the time when I want to hear them, it's because they were used as a sound clip in like a Wu-Tang track. Yeah. So, like, I want to hear the Wu-Tang quote. Gotcha. So, right. So, at this point, we have the first fake arrest of Tin, where, again, I feel kind of bad for Strepsil because his buddies kind of set him up, like, let him go and report, like, here this is. Go take this. And meanwhile, they're playing this game behind his back. And we get to see, which is really one of my favorite moments, that Aspirin does what, I don't know, I would consider his best James Bond impression.
The tuxedo.
Right, right. And it's the look on his face. Like, he's so confident. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm watching this, and the second he shows up there, I'm like, oh, what are you doing? You are going to die.
And you know, that's the scene that won him the Best Supporting Actor Award for Meng Hoi.
Oh, it did, didn't it?
Yeah.
And I think, is it, because now, again, things are going fast. So is it during this, when Dick Wei ends up going and finding Panadol in the actual microfilm?
Mm-hmm, yeah, he went to Choi Hak's apartment. Yeah. Right.
So while Aspirin is at the boss's house, right? So there's the fake arrest that's happening,
right?
And then he sends Tin, right? Sends Dick Wei
to Choi Hak's place, right?
To go get it. He recovers it, and then kills him.
Right, kills him. Like, yeah,
that was I was not expecting that.
That hurt.
And like right when his right, so then at this point, like Strepsil is like, oh, realizes what's happening, and he's like, I've got to save him. We've got to go. And like they're right outside his house when he kills him, and it felt like it's a really emotional moment. Like I was not, especially with all the especially from these characters,
right?
Like they have been so like funny throughout it that even when again like Panadol is getting attacked by four guys because of fake guns and bad passports, it's still funny, right?
Right, and that's what I mean. That's what I mean. Yeah. Whenever Meng Hoi is involved, it's always kind of dark. If you look at other like his other film, Royal Warriors in particular,
And
Legacy of Rage, they all have a little dark undertone underneath. I mean, obviously he is just a martial arts director, but I'm sure this film being a collaboration with Corey Yun, he probably has some input into making the tonal shift here a little bit more melodramatic, you know, to have a major character die. You know, remember, this was a special guest star.
Right,
as a special guest star, and you're killing off a special guest star. But no, yeah, I mean, the tonal shift. Again, audiences are kind of used to tonal shift.
Sure.
Hong Kong audiences. So some people obviously don't like it. But yeah, it's just a build-up for the emotional confrontation at the end. You know, it kind of builds up to Meng Huo killing James Tien at the end, you know, with this. Because as a revenge, you know, to remember all these dialogue about, you know, oh, yeah, you know, good guys, like, you know, good guys never get a good ending. Bad guys always go free. Never, you know, so that kind of triggered him to shoot James Tien in the end. But no, yeah, I mean, I think it's, oh, and also maybe it's their way of getting back at Trey Hart. You know, like, you know, you torture us so hard as a warrior. But you get the
right, right. Yeah, it's just, it's so sad because he's such a charismatic character, mm-hmm. right? Like, he's so magnetic that when he dies, it's so sad.
Yeah.
And then I love, like, it just sets, like, Strepsil all throughout the movie is like, he's the more clear thinking one, right? The quieter one. Like, he's the one that's like, no, let's just turn this into the cops. Like, then we get like a commando moment from him where he's like, give me all the guns.
Yes.
Right.
And then that takes us to really what is our epic showdown at the end at Tin's house.
Right.
With first Strepsis and his just enormous cachet of weapons. Mm-hmm. And then right in tow, our two hero cops, Michelle and Cynthia, ready to rock the house and come out for justice.
Hell yeah. Yeah, no, it's a great fight scene. And, you know, you have all these veteran stuntmen there, you know. King Lee, Qin Galo, Yun Miu, you know, all these are guys that have been doing all this for years, you know. Then, of course, you have Zhong Fa, you know, obviously Dick Wai, and then Meng Huo himself. And yeah, and also I like how they set up the fight, you know, like they, you know, before they shot the fight, they would say, okay, you will fight him, you know, like Michelle will fight Zhong Fa, Xinfei will fight Dick Wai. I just like how they kind of, you know, thought of it in advance. Although I do felt that it would be kind of interesting to have them cross fighting for just a little bit.
Yeah, something else you pointed out in your commentary, Frank, was the inclusion of not only just fighting now but stunts. I really like that because it's something that like I've been watching but I never noticed. Like it wasn't only just fighting now. Like there's just these insane stunts mixed in with the fights, and it's just. Is that something that like Jackie?
Well, remember, this is a Sammo Hung produced film. So obviously, Sammo Hung has some influences. Okay. Some of the stuntmen were from Sammo Hung's stunt team, you know. So I think there was a conscious attempt to add a little bit of a stunt to it, you know, especially with the falls, you know, falling to the staircase. I mean, that's crazy stuff, man, you know.
There was so much broken glass. There was so much broken glass. I loved it. I was like, wow, how much broken glass can we have in here? Honestly, I thought of John Wick 3. I was like, is John Wick 3 like a homage to this? Because in John Wick 3, they have that fight in that glass room, and so all this glass gets broken, and I'm like...
I asked Meng Huo in an interview. He said, well, because we want to keep it fresh. They felt that having stunt combined with the fight make it fresh. You know, and that's one reason why. Mm-hmm. Right? That's one reason why this film is still so fresh, 40 years and almost 40 years later. Mm-hmm. You know, because of the combination of stunts and fight. And of course, now it's all pretty common. You know, like you said, like Dominic said, you know, about the John Wick film, and of course, like the Matrix, you have stunts and fights too. But yeah, I mean, this was a pioneer. You know,
well, it's funny. Yeah. The one, the infamous stunt. In this, where the guy falls off of the balcony there, that I know, like people, some say, like, oh, there's no way that's a real person, but it is, right?
Yeah.
And it reminds me a lot of kind of the infamous similar scene in the first Raid movie where the guy falls like down and like lands on his back on the one like railing that they had said like, no, a guy really did this.
Yeah.
Like this is all he, there's no like Pat, like he truly did. They're professionals. They know how to pull this stuff off.
They rehearse it, you know, so that they won't get injured. They knew exactly where to fall, how they're going to fall, like how to soften the blow and stuff. So yeah, I mean, they rehearse and rehearse before they actually do the stunt.
Yeah, it's truly incredible. And I love that we get these scenes where Cynthia gets a weapon in her hand. I know, like, listening to her commentary with you on this scene, like, that she loves she prefers to fight with weapons. Mm-hmm. And you can just see like the moves that she does and then like the hand motions and all this. It's just, oh, I'm like out of my seat watching this because I'm like, oh my God, she's such a badass.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I want to bring up the one stunt that stood out to me. And I realized actually reading some reviews is it stood out to a lot of the reviewers too. There's one where like, there's, of course, they're on a balcony and there's a banister with glass underneath it. And Michelle's right. on top of it,
yeah.
swings around right. through it and kicks it out. Yeah. You guys know what I'm talking about? It's a crazy yes. stunt. Yes. I was like, and you know, it was a legitimate stunt. I thought it was wild. Like I was like, oh wow, I've so never great. Seen anything like this. And how many of these movies have we watched? And it's, what is this like? It's almost 40 mm-hmm. years old, and the stunts blew my mind. It was spectacular. Yeah. When I was watching this movie, I'm like, okay, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. I get it. It's good. I would have liked more fighting. But that last scene, I'm like, okay, cool. I'm in. I'm like, this is, yes. Now I highly recommend it. So it really, the climax was climactic. Like, sometimes climax can be anticlimactic. I feel like in a lot of movies, the final fight is just like, okay, we're going
to it goes back to this concept of modern fighting because this is not martial art, period martial art. You can't finish your opponent by doing what you do in martial arts. Like you can't like hit him in the groin or like crack him in the throat. You have to end it in a way that's modern, right? So that's where the stunts comes in. I mean, this is a stunt. Or this is obviously a stunt, you know, with the broken glass, swinging, all that. So that's, you know, this is not something that you would see. I mean, you won't see that in a traditional martial art film. So in many ways, this was a very transitional, you know, this was a transitional film. With the combination of the fights and the stunts.
Frank, there's one character, he's in this movie a little bit earlier, but this is really where I think he has the most play. The character of Mad Dog.
Oh, Saddam Hussein. He looks like Saddam Hussein.
And it's like this is like purposefully, right? Like the fakest looking mustache ever.
I thought that's Joan Fah's real mustache, I thought.
Is it?
Yeah, he has a mustache.
Oh, it's just that big and thick. Yeah, like that's the eyebrows.
Zhong Fa is a regular Sammo Hung stuntman. Yeah, no.
It's just he just has the big mustache.
Yeah, no, I like the characterization of Mad Dog. Yeah, no, it's
fun. Yeah, he's crazy. Yeah, that's he was fun. So I loved getting to see him fight. I loved seeing of course Dick Wei comes into this, and now we get and again, I think this is where Jay, you were talking about this before. Cynthia had mentioned when she faces off with him that the crew had said, like, oh, this guy doesn't pull punches, watch out. And I mean, you could see, like, this man, when he wades into the fight, like, he feels like he is at a different level from all the other of, you know, Tin's henchmen fighting.
But if you watch closely, Dick Wei wasn't the one getting the scorpion kick because she already injured him a little bit earlier in the. In the fight earlier, he already injured Dick Wei when she kicked him in the head. So after the part where she needs to do the scorpion kick, Dick Wei wouldn't have it. Wouldn't let her kick him.
That scorpion kick is so badass too. Yeah.
And that's not something they taught her. Like she showed up on set and was like, "Hey, Corey, I can do this thing." Like it's just so great. Like it's just. I love Cynthia.
Yeah, she's great. She's great. And this is the first movie we've really been able to talk about her. We did New York Ninja where she did the voice for. So that was fun to have her in that. But of course, we didn't actually get to see her or see any of that. So awesome to finally get to her. I mean, and Michelle Yeoh. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So that leads us, all that fighting leads us to, I don't know, for me, I was expecting in a lot of the movies we watched, you know, the bad guy gets caught, our hero cops, our heroes for the day. But I was really jarred where at the end of this, when the police come, it's the cops that get arrested and our villain gets to laugh his way away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or so we think.
Yeah, it's a nice little twist. You know, for one thing, the gun actually was a real gun.
Right, right.
And then you have you know, that comedy and drama in the tonal shift again. You know, going back to the friendship, you know, the reminder of the friendship, the flashback, and of course now that you know, Panadol is dead. And like Wang Hoi said in his interview, this was a logical conclusion. What else can you do?
Right.
You know, because police always show up at the last minute. You know, bad guys always get to leave, you know, get away. And so, you know, this is I mean, they have to take justice in their own hand.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, that, as we've talked about, you know, this is a movie that, when you think of this movie, like, look at the poster, especially, like, after posters that came out after, it's Michelle and Cynthia front and center. But the final moments of this are Aspirin and Strepsil and getting the revenge. And, I mean, the final frame of the movie is of them.
Yes, right? These three too. Yeah.
Right. But it's great. Like, that's how the movie ends. And it's still, again, very jarring that at the end, which I think fits with the movie, because really, and I think you talked about this, like, it feels like Strepsil and Aspirin get the bulk of screen time in this movie.
Yeah, they move the plot along. Yes, they do.
Yeah, so that's Yes, Madam. What a friggin' awesome film. Dom, I'm very excited to. You already previewed for us the science segment. Even though I wish we were getting taught about silenced weapons, I am sure you will deliver us incredible knowledge.
With science!
Yes, science!
Science!
It's not rocket science! Just say yes and we'll move on!
Science!
I don't think science knows, actually.
Blinded me! With science!
I mean, first things first, we could test that out ourselves. We could buy an apple. We could buy a gun. I mean, how hard could it be? We could just see how loud the shot is. All right. So, yeah. Well, you already got a preview, and we talked about it quite a bit. They're named after medications, so I figured I'd talk about that, because what else am I going to talk about over-the-counter drugs? I mean, this is an 80s season. I'm sure we're going to talk about cocaine at some point, so I'll get that one out of the way. But let's talk about over-the-counter drugs. So Strepsil, as Frank already commented, is a throat lozenge. It's actually a really old one from, like, this company is 70 years old. It gets its name from Streptococcus, which causes strep throat, as most people know about. Streptococcus is a type of bacteria, right? And it's basically a mild antiseptic with flavoring and vitamin C. So it's got two kinds of antiseptics. It's got a dichlorobenzyl alcohol. So that's an alcohol they pretty much created in a lab and functions as a mild antiseptic. And amylmetacresol, which is also another antiseptic. So it's a combination of two small, you know, light antiseptics. And you suck on the lozenge, and it's supposed to slightly kill off the bacteria. Like, it's not going to function too well at that. But what's actually interesting is they found that some of the drugs that are in this actually can function as antivirals as well. And actually, when COVID came out, some of these chemicals could actually deter COVID just a little bit. It's no replacement for vaccines, but I thought that was an interesting side note. Let's jump to Panadol next. So Panadol has acetaminophen in it, which is in Tylenol. Right now, Frank has a big grin on his face and he's cracking me up right next to a thing of pills. You look like a happy drug addict. You're like, yeah, look at this. So Panadol has paracetamol and acetaminophen. They're similar. In that both are N-acetyl aminophenols. And they're actually really, so they're painkillers and they're also fever reducers. The way they work is they inhibit localized chemicals that almost all your tissues make called prostaglandins. So it stops the synthesis of those prostaglandins. Now, what's really interesting about acetaminophen is that, and all these paracetamol and all that stuff, it's derived from coal tar. So you actually get it by taking coal, heating it up, and, like, it sweats out this tar, and that's what you make these drugs out of. So it's actually fossil fuels. So next time you take Tylenol, you're taking fossil fuels. But they recently found out that you can make it out of lignin, which is found in plants and wood and stuff. So they probably won't have to use fossil fuels to make you hurt less, which is a good thing. And the last one is aspirin. I'm sure everyone knows aspirin. Aspirin is one of my favorite chemicals, acetylsalicylic acid. I'll say it again. Acetylsalicylic acid. I love it. It's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. So steroids, of course, typically work or function like hormones, corticosteroids and stuff like that. So you can get anti-inflammatory properties without messing with your hormones, right? Interesting thing. This one is actually derived from a willow tree. willow tree, specifically the genus Salix. So yeah, willow trees, just like willow trees around here and willow trees over in Europe and Asia, it's from that bark. Yeah, and people have been taking the bark of willow trees and using it as an herbal treatment for like thousands of years. And then researchers are like, let's isolate the compound. And that's where we get aspirin from. And I love telling my students this when they're like, when do I need to learn about plants? And I'm like, well, what do you want to be? I want to be a PA. And I'm like, well, you know, all those drugs that you want your patients to use, they all come from plants. You might want to know a couple things about them. Doesn't work. They still don't give a crap. But what are you going to do?
Like we pointed out earlier, aspirin was, I think they use aspirin in the English dub version. In the Cantonese version, it's tokuhan. The Japanese version is lampas. Yeah.
Yeah.
The tokuhan in kanji means escape from the bitter sea, which means escape from the pain. So.
That's what tokuhan
very meant, interesting. Yeah. One of them, Mike, you told me one of them was had the name Saradon.
I believe Saradin? that's what the subtitles in the Cantonese version said. That was aspirin's name in that one.
Oh, okay. Well, that's an interesting one because that actually, I looked that one up too. That is a triple medication that I actually don't think is legal. It has an NSAID, like it has a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory that you can actually get from mushrooms, which is kind of interesting, but I'm sure they just synthesize it. It has paracetamol or acetaminophen in it, and it has caffeine. So it's got basically a Tylenol-like substance, an aspirin-like substance, and coffee. And that's kind of that. So basically you have the painkillers and an upper. So you don't care about anything when you take that. So thought that was interesting. All right, that's all I got. I couldn't find any more science-y stuff in this, but... It's pretty awesome that it was brought up because Frank, you have basically a drugstore in your apartment.
Oh, I stock these up every time I go to the UK.
All right, well, guys, that was a lot of fun. Jason, I think we've already kind of talked, and it's been kind of the reason for us doing this entire thing. But you know, we always like to now just highlight what are kind of the premier physical disc options because we really encourage our listeners. To support physical media. Again, if they do support physical media across any wide variety of Hong Kong and martial arts films, there's a very good chance they're going to get to hear some brilliance from Frank. Jason, would you say what would you say is the definitive current available physical edition of Yes, Madam?
Yeah, so timely, because I think this came out within the past year. It's an actual box set that 88 Films put out, and they are actually a UK company, but within the past year as well, they started releasing their discs, some of them in the United States. So this In the Line of Duty box set came out, and Yes, Madam is the second installment, even though, as Frank points out in his commentary, mm-hmm. it's the first one that was made, which I think is pretty interesting how all this comes to be. But yeah, this is definitely the disc to get. It's Blu-ray. It'll play on your Region A players. I'm not sure if they plan to release like them in individual, like all four films individually, but this box set, it's so nice. Like the extras, it's like just sits on my movie shelf, and I admire it. It's just such a great addition to any collection.
Yes, agreed. This was actually my Christmas present from my son this year, so I was very excited to get that. Again, ooh, nice. What made me really want to seek out Frank and get him on our show was listening to his commentary on Yes, Madam. Again, this is such a treat. I mean, you've given us just a lot of great information and good stuff tonight, Frank. But again, can't replace just the extraordinary commentary that you give on that disc and all the other discs in that set. So please do. Yeah. Please go get it.
Yeah. And I don't even think there's like a good DVD of this on the United States side of things. So this is a big deal getting this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Jay. Frank, again, thank you so much for joining us. We're beyond honored to have you on the show. Why don't you give our audience just a little preview into your current projects, what you have working on?
Okay. Well, I'm working on the Fist of Legend commentary for 88 Film. I'm working on the Fearless Hyena 2 commentary
for
88 Films. I know people trash that film. I think it's a fine film.
Very nice.
I mean, even though Jackie may not be in all of it, but the fights are great. I'm working on a King Wu film that I cannot review yet. Yeah, it will be reviewed soon. But so this podcast come out, you already know what title that is. I'm very honored to be able to work on a King Wu film finally. So we're finishing the extra features on the, you know, on the Bruceploitation box set, and you know, we already did the group commentary for the documentary End of the Clones of Bruce. So we're finishing the, you know, I have like two commentaries on that box set for the other two other films. Yeah, and then you know we were preparing this like kind of like a final run of the documentary in theaters in April and May, I think. Well, yeah, I mean there's still a couple of film festivals that we will be showing this. Nice. One in the UK, one here. And hopefully when in Hong Kong, you know, we always want to show in Hong Kong. So, yeah, so that's pretty much it for now. Oh, and also another Johnny To film. I'm going to do commentary on another Johnny To film and another Trey Hark film. So,
Frank, where can our audience find you on socials?
Just look for me on Instagram. Just type my name. Yeah. Look for the Snoopy sleeping on his doghouse picture.
Excellent. Excellent. Frank, again, it was an absolute treat. Hope that you will join us again in the future to break down more movies, but really appreciate you fitting us in. And I'm really excited to hear your commentary on all these movies, to see this movie, that whole Bruceploitation box set, volume one that's coming out. Mm-hmm. This is really a golden age, I think, to be fans of these movies and fans of physical media when there's so much coming out and all this stuff that just has people like you that have so much knowledge and so much passion, you know, that really give these movies the honor that they deserve, right? Like this is the whole reason that we have this podcast, because these are the kind of movies that we love. So all our listeners, again, thank you for joining us and tuning into another episode of Once Upon a Time in the 80s. We hope you're excited for even more fun times with 80s classics ahead, including more Corey Yoon. So get ready. To keep up to date, make sure you're following us on Twitter, or X, Instagram, Threads, TikTok, and Facebook. We're at Punches and Popcorn. And give us a shout. Also, make sure you're following and subscribing to us on all your favorite podcast platforms. If you like what you hear, please throw us a review on your app of choice. For even more fun, make sure you check out our partner shows on the Lunch Door Podcast Network, shows such as Behind the Glass, Food About Town, Mind of Magnus, The Level Up Podcast, Behind the Studio Door, and of course, The Pod That Made Us, Anomaly Film Festival. Until next time, friends, good night.
This has been a presentation of the Lunch Door Podcast Network.